Fun fact, 70% of Fortune 500 companies store and or derive key business data from their mainframes. You know, the sort of big compute iron that powers many of the world's largest companies. You could think of them as the unsung heroes of the data center. Yet when we think of modernization initiatives, you know, generative AI, machine learning, and cloud, well, the mainframe's often perceived as something as distinct or detached, something for the other part of the business. Well, today's guest thinks this is a missed opportunity, especially when it's hybrid cloud services that are likely to benefit the most from integration with the kinds of high-volume, millisecond latency, secure transactions that mainframes are renowned for. And in so doing, might even unleash a whole new raft of business application innovation. Well, Phil Buckaloo is a Harvard MBA whose tech career spans both the public cloud and on-premises infrastructure businesses, having served as general manager for IBM's public cloud platform before joining Rocket Software as president of the infrastructure modernization business. And he's here today to talk to us about hybrid cloud and the mainframe. Hey, Phil, welcome to Digital Disrupted.
Hey, thanks, Paul. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. I don't think I've seen you, certainly not face-to-face, since the beginning of the year. You have been busy. We're going to get to that in a minute. But before we do a little something we call the lightning round on the podcast. It's a chance for our audience to get to know our guest through a slightly quirky lens. You ready to play the game?
I think so. Let's do it.
You're in safe hands. All right. First question, your advice to people starting their careers.
I think it's important to try a lot of different things. You might not know that you really like something or that you don't like something until you've tried it. I think a lot of people try to have their lives all planned out, you know, from the start, and they know exactly what they're going to do. But life can throw you a lot of curveballs, and it's good to try a lot of different things. And that way you'll really narrow in on what you like and what you don't like.
Well, I'm going to ask you a bit about your background in just a minute. So we'll put that idea to the test. We'll see what sort of linear path or not that your career took. Next question. If you could use technology to solve one world problem, what would it be and why?
I think poverty is probably the biggest challenge, one of the biggest challenges that we face. I think being able to address it in a meaningful way is something that is possible, but requires a lot of commitment and a lot of focus from governments and NGOs and the like. And it's just a real big problem, but something I think technology could help with.
It's a noble goal too. All right, well, on to something slightly different. Maybe you could share a lesson you've learned from your biggest failure.
Sometimes in the past, I think that I've missed out on context. One time I took a job and it was into a new part of the organization. Most of my career has been software. But I took a job in services, and I didn't really, this is one of those trying new things that I just mentioned, but I didn't really have the full context when I went in. It didn't work out for me. I stayed for about 9 months and then went back to the software business from there. So really, I think the lesson there is it's good to try things, but try to have as much context as you can going in and really, you know, having good mentors and sponsors, you can't say enough about that. And that's important for all of us to try to get, but also those of us that have been around a while to try to help others to move their careers along in the same way.
Yeah, if I could ad lib on the back of what you've just described, I found when I've had similar situations where I've moved into a new role and it didn't quite work out, it tested some skills that maybe I wasn't as developed on as I needed to, or the brief was wrong. But it also gave me a newfound respect for the people who do those roles. I don't know if that resonates with you.
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things you can do is to have empathy. That's one of our core values at Rocket Software, where I work today. And having that empathy usually comes from walking in the shoes of other people. That's why trying a lot of different things is also useful, because you'll tend to have more empathy for the different people that you're working with.
If you could be remembered for one thing, it would be?
I think I'm always willing to listen and learn. And I think I'm always willing to try new things. Like, some people have the novelty gene, you know, and I feel like I'm one of those people that's always trying to try new things, be it foods or going places and all of those things. So people might remember me for someone that's somewhat adventuresome, but always willing to try new things.
What's a trait? We talked about values before. What's a trait you value most in work relationships?
I think it's got to be trust. That's really what most businesses is built on. And it's hard to earn that trust. Usually the trust doesn't come from words, but it comes from deeds. And so the people that I really trust, that's invaluable. And you really want to do business with people you trust as well. So that's really kind of a foundational value. And that's what I look for most in people.
All right. And the last question for the lightning round, the technology innovation that has made the greatest impact on your life.
It's probably Google Maps. I have a terrible sense of direction. I get lost. I can get lost in my old neighborhood. It's so bad. And so that has helped me to be a functional human in the world. And I'm so grateful.
And I appreciate you being vulnerable with that, with your spatial disorientation. All right. Well, let's jump into this, what I thought was a really provocative point of view about this idea of bringing the mainframe into the world of, I'm guessing, public cloud. We'll get to that in a second. But before we do, tell us a little bit about your background. I'm curious as to how Phil came to be where he is.
I studied in school. I grew up in Texas. I studied COBOL. Actually, I was a COBOL programmer in school in addition to being a business major, but I wanted to try something new. So I went off to Procter & Gamble and went into the consumer products business. I was actually working there and at some other companies doing brand management, including such glamorous portfolios as soap and toilet paper and paper towels. So a lot of experience with consumer products, but I couldn't really get the technologist out of me. So I went back to business school, and then from there, I got into technology. I worked with IBM for about 22 years, lots of different parts of the technology space, and I've loved it. It's really what gets me going and keeps me going. And so every different type of enterprise software, and then most recently, before I left IBM, was public cloud. And now I've been with Rocket Software. I lead the infrastructure modernization team. That's the team that has most of our mainframe products. And it's been fantastic to have taken some of my experiences in other parts of enterprise software and see how really clients can get even more out of their mainframe investments. It's something that I'm really passionate about. And I think there's just unbounded opportunity in. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked briefly before recording this episode, just getting a little bit of background as to some of the untapped opportunity I mentioned in the opening, which I thought was fascinating. We also talked a little bit about the mainframe's persistence in certain transactional environments. Do you want to talk a little bit about why the mainframe does remain so sticky, relevant, and seems to have a robust future with so many businesses around the planet?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, the technology on the mainframe has come a long way. And so there's a lot of capabilities from the hardware itself that are somewhat unique and very important. Being able to scale up, which is be able to handle like lots and lots of transactions with really low latency, at the same time, you preserve reliability and security. If anybody's kind of looked at a mainframe, you know, there's all this redundancy built in for networking cards and memory and power and cooling and all this other capability. And that's what kind of gives it its reliability characteristics that, you know, companies want. On top of that, it's been around for 40 years. So, or 60 years, I guess, more accurately. But a lot of the applications that are running the world's, you know, finances and keeping the planes in the air and the trains moving, we're all built on applications. I was a COBOL programmer. A lot of that stuff's written in COBOL. And so it, you know, maintaining that and keeping that code running, that those projects evolved over decades. And it's not just writing the applications with all this business logic in it, but it's also going with working with regulators and making sure that change control is in place and, you know, the things that are systemically important to our world are able to function. And so you get all of those things kind of coming together And that's why it's been really an irreplaceable part of most IT infrastructures. And that's why it's had the longevity that it's had, because it can do these things reliably and securely and with the availability that's needed for that mission critical kind of workload.
Yet you believe that it's being perhaps either relegated or misunderstood when it comes to some of these modernization initiatives that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. It's become something of a blind spot, I should say, when it comes to getting the most out of projects like, say, AI and ML, which are, you know, incredibly data hungry. What are your thoughts on some of the, I guess, both the practicalities, but also politics? I think there's something of a balkanization of IT, right? Where there are certain people who just look at the mainframe and go, look, I don't understand it. I've never learned COBOL. It's all a bit too hard. I'm just going to forget about it, resulting as in this blind spot that I mentioned. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, along with the strengths of the mainframe, there's also some weaknesses in place, and that, you know, there's a lot of people that have been around working in the mainframe. They're, you know, more senior in their careers. Some of them have retired. Some of the people that wrote the applications that are running the world, you know, have, you know, left the workforce. And so you have everyone coming out of school is trained on cloud and cloud native technologies and modern DevOps approaches and not traditional waterfall type, you know, ways that the mainframe and their applications were historically run. So you kind of get this, you know, these two worlds are colliding. The cloud has a lot of benefit itself. Having worked in cloud for 5 years, I saw what it was really good at, which was like elastically scaling. If you want to use 1,000 virtual machines or containers, but you only want to use it for an hour and you only want to pay for what you use, well, that's great in a public cloud multi-tenant kind of world, but that's not necessarily what you get out of the mainframe. And like on the cloud side, it's got weaknesses too. We always fought with noisy neighbor problems because it's multi-tenancy. You know, if somebody's using that as 1,000 VMs, well, that might slow down your credit card processing, and that's not great either. And so we've kind of evolved to this state where you've got these people in their camps and they don't really want to talk to or work with people, which is part of the political problem. Like the cloud people think everything always has to be on the cloud, and the mainframe people think you should never let any data off your mainframe because it's the only place it's safe and secure. So you get these warring factions.
Have you been spying on my meetings? Is that what's going on?
Exactly. And you get like teams that don't want to communicate, that don't want to work together. And then you have different development processes and it can just spiral out of control. And so you get both parties not wanting to work with the other party. And then it becomes political, you know, hot potatoes. And that's what kind of slows the progress. And that's why, you know, we really think there's a better way than trying to have all your teams fighting.
Well, the other thing we spoke about, again, before the recording was this idea that the sort of data that people are feeding into their artificial intelligence, their RPA, their robotic process automation tools and so forth, for example, things like especially looking for, you know, potential security attacks or identity spoofing that can occur, they're leaving a lot of that incredibly rich data, often transactional, high-speed data, out of their ML models because I guess they just see it as a bridge too far, or they use reduced data when they're training their models and therefore are not getting the sort of fidelity they otherwise could. Do you want to touch on that for a second?
Yeah, so I think you're right, Paul. I mean, you've got the hot thing right now is generative AI and predictive AI and being able to use, you know, new models to help you run your business better. And say, you know, you've got a lot of, you know, traditional companies, enterprises that have been a long time, and they're competing against, the banks are competing with fintechs and soft startups that need to be leveraging and are leveraging all of this, you know, these new as a service offerings and specific hardware training models to do certain things. And that's a reality in the marketplace that we're in today. But if you're an enterprise and you've got 70% or more of your data that comes from or is derived from the mainframe, and that's really not part of those training sets that you're going to be using, then you're not going to be able to compete. That's your strategic advantage. And you're not using your data from your transactions, which is the most important part of your business in many cases, to build these models and to be able to execute them. And I think the perception these days has been that, well, okay, to use the cloud, you know, back to the warring factions, you got to move all of your applications and transactions off the mainframe and reconstitute them on the cloud. And that's just ridiculous. I mean, the two worlds can, should, will, and do coexist. And you can get the best of both worlds. You can get the security, the reliability, the availability of the mainframe, and then also use data or subsets of that data, often filtering out some of the credit card numbers, PII data, the important stuff, so that the data that you need for training your models does land on those clouds, where you can use that elastic compute and those as a service offerings and the specialized hardware to train those Gen AI models. And then what people often don't think about is that for running the transactions, the mainframe is still one of the best in the world. IBM introduced this thing called the Telum chip, and it's a part of the mainframe that can do like 300 billion inference requests per day in a single day. And so think about like if you're trying to buy something in a store, you swipe your credit card. You swipe your credit card, and then the banks and others, they have to do fraud checks. And the amount of time that it takes to do the fraud checks needs to be in milliseconds, or else you're going to, you know, pull out another credit card or use other some other form of payment. And so that's what the inferencing is. So you can still train those models on public clouds benefiting from elastic compute while leveraging the inferencing and the capability of the transaction processing that exists on the mainframe to make sure that you hit those tight millisecond SLA windows. That's really how these worlds can coexist without needing to go completely to one camp or completely to the other camp.
So follow-up question to that then, is that what you've just described, that idea of the interoperability of the two, your definition of hybrid cloud and the mainframe world? Maybe you want to expand on what you mean by hybrid cloud when we talk about that.
Yeah, what we mean by hybrid cloud is like you need to use what each platform's good at. And so you don't try to go all one way or all the next. Typically those big, like we've seen banks and others that have tried to like completely, you know, rip and replace, build everything brand new. There was a bank in the UK that had like 50 million pounds in fines and had to scrap the whole project. Those things happen when you try to take 40 years of application code and just spin it up on the new on something brand new. That's risky. It's a lot better to kind of go incrementally and to use what the platforms are good at. And so the biggest thing that we're fighting is the perception that to benefit from public cloud, everything has to be public cloud. And that's just really not the case. So what we talk about is in the hybrid cloud is modernization without disruption. So don't go through the big disruptive rip and replace, try to write all your, you know, have your COBOL generated into Java and all of these other, you know, very long-term risky propositions, but instead, you know, let the two coexist with what they're good at. And that's primarily what we mean by hybrid cloud. We also talk about being able to modernize without disrupting your environment. And that can include other things as well, like modernizing your DevOps process. There's no reason that mainframers have to build their code with waterfall approaches. They can use agile, modern DevOps, DevSecOps tooling. And so that's an area where we're trying to help our clients to really modernize their environment.
Okay, so we should be able to find ourselves in a position where the two worlds can interoperate more closely in a more seamless transactional style environment, and to be able to do it using the sorts of tool sets and methodologies that are consistent across the organization. You talked about some of the pitfalls of trying to, you know, rip and replace the mainframe. I guess the same might apply in reverse. How difficult, how much effort am I going to have to go through, and to how much cost, risk, disruption to my team to apply some of these concepts back to the mainframe? What do you envisage, or perhaps what are you working on to help make that process easier for people who are trying to take advantage of this?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, but you've got to start with what your business objectives are. If your business objectives are to move faster, maybe to, like, if you're a bank and you want to compete with the fintechs, then having a development process that's more agile has got to be a goal. And a lot of times that means using more open source technology, something that hasn't always been around or supported on the mainframe. So one of the things we've done at Rocket Software is we ported GitHub and Bash and curl and a lot of these important DevOps type open source packages, we ported those to ZOS and to the mainframe so that customers that are used to using these agile DevSecOps pipelines can use some of the same pieces on the mainframe itself. And so that starts to get over some of this dissonance because, you know, I'd mentioned the warring factions before. If you've got an agile team that's pushing code, you know, a couple times a day or even, you know, every 2 weeks in sprints, and they run up against a mainframe team that's only used to restarting their environment twice a year, and they push changes on a very different path, then that's why you're going to get these warring factions. If we can have the two groups to like have the fast app dev people work through change of field length, add a column to a database table faster, then they don't care where the technology runs as long as it's meeting their development processes. And so that's an example of the kind of thing that we're doing to help these groups modernize.
Yeah, and I suppose my question is that a big risky project to embark on trying to change the way the mainframe team work, or is that something that with your experience you've been able to simplify and accelerate, or is there tooling perhaps to help them do that without a lot of disruption? I'm just curious as to what the change management experience is like.
Well, it's interesting in that you do have like different people that want different things. So you've got some traditional mainframers that have been around for 4 years and they're used to using the green screens and the, you know, the typical tools that they've used in the past. And they want to keep using those because they've memorized all of the, you know, things that help them go really fast. At the same time, you get kids coming out of school that don't ever want to look at a green screen. They want to use VS Code or some modern, you know, app dev tool. And so one of the things that we've done with some others in the industry is we've invested in open source projects like the Zoe, which is from the Open Mainframe project, which allows you to put more modern front ends on top of things that can still be accessed but are available through green screens. We've taken a lot of our tooling and built it into VS Code. Other vendors have too. Those are the kinds of things that let you kind of coexist with the new kids coming out of school that want to use more modern tools and modern IDs with mainframers that want to use what they've always used. And they, if you make it such that you have flexibility and you don't have to pick one or the other, then that's really how you help the teams coexist. And then it becomes a lot less disruptive. You know, the real disruptive things are when you have to change people and change people's behavior. And so it's those change management type of, you know, gun to your head, you got to use something different kind of projects, either going, you know, to use older technology or newer technology that we're focused on eliminating those so that things can go much more smoothly and then they're easier to adopt and have businesses get value from.
Look, I love it. And just as a quick aside, I was watching a flame war develop on Twitter the other day. Who'd have thought people arguing on Twitter? But it was between a group of Unix system admins, and somebody had placed a screenshot up there of a problem they were working on. And instead of responding to the problem they were working on, this person was subjected to a litany of abuse about asking, you know, these modern DevOps folks asking why this person was accessing the shell terminal to get work done, right? Speaking of Bash earlier on. And I guess it does highlight what you were talking about, which is, you know, if you were a Unix systems admin from 20, 30 years ago and you're used to doing things a certain way, it's really hard to get you to change your behaviors overnight. I mean, it does take training, it takes motivation, it takes incentivization. There's a lot of things you need to do to get people to change their ways, whether it's on the mainframe or in, you know, the most modern of modern systems.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, the mainframe itself, because it was these raised floors, you know, it was this special on-prem environment you could only access through the green screens. I think it is historically throughout the long arc of its career. In fact, that's some of the security benefits, honestly, but it's been even more isolated. So there's even less familiarity with some of the tools, the approaches, in the ways of operating it. So the more we can lower the barriers for people to try and use the mainframe, then that usually helps our clients because they can attract more people and address kind of the skills problem that does exist with a lot of different companies these days.
I've got a couple more questions for you before we wrap up. Thank you for being so generous with your time this morning as well. So you mentioned security just then. So I think it's worth touching on. You know, we've seen breach after breach announced. You know, you pretty much a day. You almost can't go an hour without learning about some sort of new high-profile data or application breach. The mainframe is, I think, rightly regarded as being the sort of bastion of a high degree of security. It seems somewhat incompatible with this notion of pulling the mainframe into the hybrid cloud. Are we opening doors for increased risk here or not?
I think you are. And I think that's something that most operators of mainframes need to actually take more seriously. A lot of the security on the mainframe came from security through obscurity. Probably heard that phrase before. There's not as many people that know how to use it, and therefore the attack surface is smaller than open source sitting out in the cloud somewhere. But as the mainframe has been exposed more to open systems, to cloud systems and the like through APIs and through other access methods, then you start to need to do more of the same things that have been going on in the distributed world for a lot longer. We've recently introduced some security vulnerability scanners into the space that can really tear down and look for, you know, unauthorized or potential holes or vulnerabilities that need to be fixed, especially in the vendor software space. That's the kind of example of what most of our companies and regulators as well are starting to insist on more from their clients. The overall benefits of the mainframe are still absolutely there. You can run full box encryption on like every single, you know, piece or part of a transaction, which is much harder and much more expensive to do on other platforms. So it still has the fundamental bones that allow for that kind of security that everybody depends on. But you really have to watch your processes and you have to make sure that you're using best practices. And that's what we try to work with a lot of clients around, to make sure they're doing the kind of pen tests, they're doing the kind of security vulnerability scans that are really needed to find and address potential vulnerabilities, because no one really wants to be held up by the ransomware waves that are affecting our world.
No doubt about it. Lastly, just to follow up on the sort of ease of adoption and migration into a hybrid. Well, I'm just wondering if you can touch on a recent acquisition that Rocket Software made of a company called BOS or BOS, and just what it might mean for the tech industry.
Yeah, we've been in the data space for quite a while. We've got some data intelligence products that help look for lineage and try to understand data, especially in hard to understand formats in the mainframe. We've had data virtualization capabilities for a decade where clients can take queries from off platform and have them go pull information back from the mainframe, from those data sets. That's been a space we've been in for a very long time. But our clients kept asking us, in certain cases, you need to take some of that data and replicate it off to a public cloud or distributed service, because you might hit it a bunch of times through different training routines or others. And sometimes clients want to have parts of applications that run in the cloud or elsewhere, and they need a near real-time replication of that transaction. They don't want to move the transactions, but they want to have a replica of that data set on an Azure or an AWS or a Google Cloud so that they can use it for more purposes. And so since we had the data intelligence, we had a lot of the virtualization capabilities, we knew about the space, we went and acquired BOS Software out of Germany. It's a company that's been around for 30 years, like ourselves. And so they've, you know, they're tried and true, they're tested, they're known by mainframe communities as being able to safely access a lot of these hard to access data sets like Adabase and IDMS and vSAM that are really hard to be able to get data from and access it from elsewhere. And so the acquisition is something we're really excited about, because not only can it get to lots of different mainframe targets, but it's easy to map that data. Because remember, the mainframe is still using EBCDIC and not ASCII, and it has different formats that a developer thought of, you know, 40 years ago and put into a vSAN file. And being able to get that out, map it, and put it into Azure Postgres or S3 on AWS, or to be able to go to, you know, BigQuery, Snowflake, those other targets, that's what our clients really want. They want to be able to mix and match, take data from an IMS source and a vSAN source and land it in, you know, a Postgres database on Azure and maybe S3 on AWS. And so that's the kind of thing that Boss Software and their flagship product, TC Vision, has been doing for quite a while. So we're going to be taking the product to market. We're calling it a Rocket Data Replicate and Sync, to be very descriptive for what it does. And we think it's really going to help accelerate a lot of clients that know that they know they want to keep their transactions safe and sound in the database. I mean, on the mainframe. But at the same time, they've got all these kids coming out of school that are trained up on all these as a service offerings in the public cloud. And this is going to allow them to get that value without a big disruptive, you know, migration of some sort. So we're super excited about it. A lot of the partners that we work with, the cloud providers and clients, they're really anxious to get their hands on it. So we're really excited.
And rightly so. Hey, Phil, it's been brilliant having you on. Thank you for taking the time to be here. If people are interested in learning more, where can they go?
Well, at rocketsoftware.com, we've got a lot of information on the capabilities that we've got. We're also attending a lot of different conferences for mainframes and others around the world. So, you know, please engage us, please reach out, you know, find me as an individual. I've got a lot of good content out there as well. You know, happy to talk with you, happy to work with our clients, partners, to help make sure that they really can get that best of worlds modernization without the disruption.
Excellent. So, hey, you mentioned the values of Rocket Software at the beginning of the episode. Just curious, Rocket, as you know, I've got the values that you all talk about that matter to the business, corporate values, company values, empathy, humanity, trust, and love. Just curious, doesn't need to be one of those four. It could be your cat. What matters to you right now?
I think it's the people, really. I mean, any company is built on the people, and what those values are about is making sure that we all treat each other as humans. We understand the shoes that other people are walking in. We do what we say we're going to do. And that goes for our clients too. And really, you know, having that love for what we do and the people we do it with, those are the things that really make Rocket Software, I believe, unique in the industry and the kind of place that I know I and my peers really enjoy working at. So it's a good company sitting on a strong foundation of values.
Awesome stuff. Well, thank you, Phil. And thanks again to Rocket Software for making today's episode possible. Thank you all for listening in. If you like what you've heard, you know, smash that subscribe button, as the young folks say. Leave a review on whatever podcatcher you happen to be listening to us on, and or reach out to us on social media, whether it's LinkedIn, Twitter, etc. So if you've got any ideas for guests or topics you'd like to hear covered on future episodes, or questions for Phil, feel free to reach out. We read every comment. With that, we'll see you all next week. Stay disruptive, everybody.